Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How are you? Are you okay? Is everything, you and your people, all right? You all right? In this era of no good news, violence and horror and sadness. I hope you and yours are okay, as I said before, and I wanted to remind you, Seattle, don't forget you can come meet me and Brendan this Saturday, November 11th. We'll be at Third Place Books in Seward Park doing a talk, taking your questions, and signing copies of Waiting for the Punch. That's 7 p.m. on Saturday, November 11th. Come on, Seattle. I might go get some scallops down at Joe's Fish Shack down in Pike's Market, where you just sit there and get a little basket of fried scallops or fish, bowl of cioppino maybe. I could do that. Fuck it, man. Gonna eat some bad shit. Wait, let's do an email first. If any of you are under the impression that I'm getting better, I think I am. There's a lot of good things going on. But there are moments that I don't feel good about. This guy didn't seem to have a problem with it, but I get emails, I get feedback sometimes. Subject line, at the book event in LA, I had a very Marin, in quotes, interaction with you. Mark, the event in LA was great. I've just started the book and I'm really enjoying it. I've been a listener for a while now and I've heard a lot of the podcast is pulled from, but it's put together in a really nice way. Great work by Brendan and you. I had a pretty great interaction with you at the end of the signing that was somehow exactly what I would expect from you in a hilarious way. See right there, I'm like, okay, what's coming at me? I was wearing a Dodgers cap and Brendan thanked me for coming out to the event during the World Series. You looked up for a second from signing a book and asked, if they win tonight, is it over? When my girlfriend began to explain that it was only game 5 and that the series would be coming back to LA for game 6 and maybe 7, you cut her off and said, oh, I don't care. Then went back to signing a book. It was the perfect, lovable, curmudgeon response. It's been making us laugh since Sunday, and I just wanted to let you know. Thanks, man, Andrew. I guess it was a tone thing, because when I read that, that sounds like I was being a dick, but maybe if it was sort of like, oh, no, I don't care. Like, if it was like that, I'll assume that it was like that. Because if I was just sort of like, yeah, fuck it, I don't care, it would seem rude to your girlfriend from the read. But maybe, okay. I'll let it be a good experience for you. I'm not going to take that away from you. Did I mention Jenna Fisher is on the show? Jenna Fisher from The Office, and she wrote a book. She wrote a book called The Actor's Life, A Survival Guide. But it was a very pleasant conversation, I might say. So I did a benefit for myeloma. Ugh, how do you say it? Myeloma, I think. The horrible blood cancer that Peter Boyle died of. Ray Romano has been hosting a benefit for myeloma for the last decade and change, 11 years. Maybe this was the 11th year. And I was asked to go to come down and do 7 to 10. Nice tight one for the good. Raise some money to help myeloma get fixed, cured, treated, managed, handled, corralled, booted out of the body. But it was interesting because it was me and Hannibal Buress, Nikki Glaser was there, Rachel Feinstein, Eliza Schlesinger. They've all been on my show. Ray was there, Fred Willard, Robert Klein. I feel like I'm missing somebody. But it was kind of interesting hanging out in the dressing room. I walked back to the dressing room and it was just Fred Willard and a very kind of bright blue suit, sitting alone by himself with no refreshments or food. Just, that was the green room. It's like, whoa, how you doing? Fred, it seems wild in here. And Willard said, yeah, I invited a lot of people. So Willard's a very funny man. And Robert Klein, who I've met many times, I've interviewed him. I've had my problems with him in the past that he didn't remember. He had no recollection of meeting me, which is fine. But Klein and Fred Willard are in their 70s, well into their 70s. And it was interesting. It's interesting to watch men in their 70s interact. And they've known each other. They were at Second City together years ago, I believe. But they don't see each other a lot. And I realize something about men of that age when they haven't seen each other. And even if they have, but they don't see each other regularly, when they do get together, they're really just, the interaction is really a prolonged jogging of each other's memory. Like, you know, it's really, they challenge each other to remember things. That seems to be the entire interaction after a certain age. I think you can cover what's happening immediately in the present. It seems pretty quickly. But then it's sort of like, what was that guy's name from the thing? Joe. That's right. All right. That's 1 point for you. What's the question? Who is Joe's wife? Oh, Jesus. Which one? Which wife? Which of the three? The second one? Was that Joanne? Oh, yeah. Point for me. So where did we do that show? Was that in the one with me and you? And I think the other guy was there. Where was that? Was that in Albany? Oh, Connecticut. All right. Do I lose a point now? It's just sort of fascinating and endearing that's really what, and it's sweet. You know, why wouldn't we want to try to remember things that were pleasurable? That's got to be one of the great capacities of the human mind, especially in dark times, is to remember good things without being too nostalgic. You want to be careful of malignant nostalgia. You don't want to be overcome by the beauty of a past that your brain reconstructs and revises and mythologizes to keep you engaged in something pleasant, somewhere to go back to. You don't want to spend too much time there. Fortunately, my brain seems to be just rotting in terms of memory anyway. So, but here's the thing. So I was jotting down the note of having that realization about older men getting together. I wrote it down in my notebook. Klein was sitting next to me. And he said with a sort of a paranoiac, suspicious tone, what are you writing down? Like I was jotting down notes for a new blog post on Fred Willard and Robert Klein's interaction backstage at a cancer benefit. I said, I'm writing the idea down for a joke, Robert. You remember? He's like, oh, you still write? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been a while since, I guess I'm busy, I guess. I don't know. No problem. Can I finish writing it down now, Mr. Klein? Guns are bad. They should be managed. Right? Am I right? A lot of them out there. A lot of them out there. Hey, so, look. Jenna Fischer is amazing. She's adorable. She's great. She's memorable. Amazing part on The Office. Everybody loves her. And I was excited to talk to her. Her new book is called Actor's Life, A Survival Guide. It's got a foreword by Steve Carell. You can pre-order it now, and it comes out November 14th, wherever you get books. This is me and the lovely Jenna Fischer.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Fucking. You're the lady I know from the television that I feel familiar with because you've been on television.
I feel familiar with you because I've listened to your podcast so much and also seen you on television.
Well, that gives you one extra thing. You probably know me better than I know you.
This is probably true.
Yeah.
Because you talk about your actual self.
I do.
Yeah.
But you didn't on television. It's weird. I always wonder. That's sort of a hard thing to deal with, isn't it? That people assume they know you from your character.
It's weird because I always say it's like having an identical twin. And one of the twins is like really well known and famous, but I'm the other twin.
Right.
So people are always coming up to me saying Pam and regarding me like Pam. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. You mean my sister. But you know what's crazy? John Heder, you know, from Napoleon Dynamite, he has an identical twin brother.
He does?
Yes.
Have you met him?
Yes. Can you imagine what it's like for his identity? Like that is real. Like he actually, there is a guy who isn't John.
Who looks just like him.
Yes.
And that's such a weird cult-figured character.
Yes. Can you imagine the hell of his life when his brother was like blowing up?
What's he been doing?
John?
Yeah.
I don't know. I saw him at the zoo recently. We both had our kids at the zoo and we ran into each other.
Wasn't he in one of the wacky big movies?
He's been...
Was it the volleyball one or no? It was the other one, a skate one.
I did Blades of Glory with him.
Right, Blades of Glory. You were in that.
Yeah, but...
And that's where you met him?
Yeah. And then we kind of lost touch, but he lives out of town. He's got he had a family and settled kind of outside of the city a little
bit. Is he one of those like unique and respectable people that made a little bit of money and they're like, I don't need this shit?
Kind of. I think so. I think so. Yeah.
I love those people. They're just like, you know, how much do I really need to not be here anymore? Or do this necessarily.
It's kind of true.
Yeah.
It's like, I did it.
Yeah.
I'm done.
What are you could do that.
They're the people who leave Vegas early.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm up.
Yeah.
I'm out of here. I'm cashing in.
No, get back here.
No, you can win more. Yeah. Just stay. You can have more.
I just break even. I'm out.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You go through that horrible wave of like, I've lost everything. I've went to the ATM twice. And then you hit that even point. You're like, I can't take it.
I add my ATM fees into my
gambling
losses, and that causes me anxiety.
How long have you had this horrible gambling problem?
I had a bit of a poker obsession many years ago.
Well, you were on the show too. Like, didn't you do
the TV? Celebrity Poker Showdown? Yeah. You know what's crazy about that?
No.
Was that filmed like months after Hurricane Katrina?
Yeah.
And it filmed in New Orleans.
Yeah.
So they flew us in on a private jet. The only time I've ever been on a private jet.
Ever?
Ever in my life.
To this day.
To this day.
Uh-huh.
Was to fly and do Celebrity Poker Showdown.
In
New Orleans.
Flood-ravaged New Orleans.
Yes. So I land in a private jet. They load me into a limousine with all the other actors and comedians.
Yeah.
And then they drive us through miles and miles and miles of devastation. I mean, I've never felt like such an asshole in my whole life. Like for real. Like the car ride was silent.
Why wasn't that the conversation?
No one was at all speaking.
At the poker table. Why didn't you open with that?
I mean, I think if you watch it, you can still see the effects of that in the game. Like, we're just like, we're so sorry.
Where was it done? At a casino?
Where was it done?
Why was it done in New Orleans to begin with? They were probably trying to bring back...
They probably
business, you know.
That's a good question.
Like, we're okay. Look, we're playing cards.
Yeah, I don't know, but I remember driving through and just
It's horrible.
The news couldn't show me it.
I went there later than that, and it was still fucked. You know, pretty fucked up.
Just like entire strip malls
gone.
Just nothing.
Yeah,
abandoned car. I thought, how do you even clean this up? I don't even know.
Yeah,
how you deal with this? Well, now, of course, I think that with
Houston.
Hurricane Harvey and Irma and everything.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in, I don't have to put these on, right?
No.
Should I put these on?
No.
Okay, good.
You don't have to.
You
seem to know how to talk to a microphone.
Okay, good. It makes me self-conscious when I hear my own voice.
Does it
into
really?
My own. Yeah. It makes me start speaking like an NPR person.
Oh, really?
More slowly and thoughtfully. And I don't want to do that.
Let's do that like in the middle
unless,
for just like 10 minutes.
Unless you like it.
When we get to a particularly, so maybe an emotional part or something, reflection you're having, we should use the headphones.
I'll slow down.
Reflection headphones.
Okay.
Like, what did you think of that? And you're like, hold on. And put that in.
You know how I felt was very, very sensitive.
Yeah.
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah. Not many people do that. I mean, I not many that I've talked to. I think Ham grew up there, right?
Yeah,
John Ham.
He did.
I've been to St. Louis. I like it. I went up into the arch.
You did the arch. Rickety elevator.
Years ago, I did that. Yeah, that goes up at a curve.
Yeah.
It's just you and two other people or
no,
something.
No, it feels like you're going to die.
Yeah.
They haven't figured out how to get you up there more efficiently.
It's a pretty American city.
Yes.
Uh-huh. William Burroughs, I think, is from there. Now I'm just throwing stuff out. What do you go back?
All the time.
You do?
Yeah.
You love it?
My folks live there.
Really?
And my sister and her family live there. So I go back all the time.
So is it still, is it okay there?
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, there's things about it that I miss and that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always surprised at the amount of ample parking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a joke. Like, I really mean it. Like, you can just park. If you want to go to a restaurant, you just park at it.
Well, is it a populated city? Is it one of those cities that got suburbanized and everyone left and now they tried to make it hip again? So they built some restaurants and people come in on weekends, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I never go into St. Louis City.
Right.
Like, where the Capitol is and the arch and the, unless no. you go to a ball game.
Right.
You know, and they did try. They tried to build it up.
Yeah.
I have a friend who bought a condo and was like, I'm going to be part of the reinvention of the city.
Uh-huh.
And it ended up like blowing up and it didn't work out. She had to sell it at a loss. It didn't work. But no, it is. It's a suburban sprawl.
Down there by herself?
Yeah, she was. It was. She was like, no one else came. No one has come.
It's going to happen.
I'm alone. We would visit her. Yeah. I'd go down and visit her. She had
empty,
a great place.
Empty streets.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, L.A. was like that for a while when people started moving downtown.
L.A. Yeah. I know.
And now it seems to be happening.
It seems like it is happening.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like more and more people.
I hear that.
It's actually happening.
I hear that.
Yeah. I hear it. Yeah.
I don't know.
I've visited
people down there.
Me too.
Yeah. They seem okay.
It seems good. But then like you go one block too far and it's super scary.
Well, yeah, but that's most cities, really,
yeah.
Right? But it's still kind of like, is L.A. really, was it ever meant to be a walking city? What are you going to do down there?
I don't know. Yeah, that's the thing.
Like, New York is New York. Like, you know,
yes.
You got to walk everywhere. It's what you do there because it's the best option, or get on a subway.
Yeah, and
LA,
Chicago is Chicago.
Exactly.
Like, Chicago's like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But down there, it's like, it's four blocks. What do you...
Yeah.
Exactly,
it's true. We've renovated four blocks of downtown Los Angeles. So enjoy. Everything's close.
I don't know. I don't know how to live like a grown up. But you're over there near me.
Yeah, I'm an East Sider.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just looking. I like it. I drove through Glendale the other day I took a shortcut to somewhere.
It's great.
And I was like, people, this is good. This is how people live.
It's the best kept secret, I think.
Well, I think it's stigmatized.
There's in what way?
I don't know. Just Glendale.
I know. Every time I say it, but I'm like, people react as if they're embarrassed for
me.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, what happened?
Oh, really? And I'm like, you guys, it's great.
It is great. And there's really beautiful parts of Glendale.
There are. And we live within walking distance of a park and also, which is great for kids.
Yeah.
But then there's like this little towny area that we can walk to, and you can get like stuff from a bakery and coffee,
yeah.
And I don't know.
Yeah.
I like that stuff.
Yeah, Pasadena too. You say Pasadena,
yeah.
People are like, oh god. But then all of a sudden now it's, you go Altadena, they're like, oh really? What's that like? It's further away.
Yeah,
and it's like it's hit or miss up there. It's like the Wild West.
I just think that the East Side part of Los Angeles is like the best.
Me too. And it's closer to highways and we can get out. Maybe,
mm-hmm.
Maybe if the shit goes down, we might be able to get out.
You think we can?
Maybe. Go up
are
to
you,
2.
Are you worried about it?
Yeah. Hit the 2, get on the 210 and just go.
You have an actual exit plan. You just named roads.
Yeah. I'm gonna go east, man. Get away from however they're going to come. They got to come east. You can't go in the water. So we're on the east
You're
part.
Right. That's right. We're already inland.
That's right.
We're going to keep going.
Yeah. And then it'll get bogged down somewhere. So wait. So now St. Louis, how many? You got a sister?
I have one sister. She's younger.
What's she doing?
She's a teacher. She's a third grade teacher.
What'd your mom do?
She was a teacher. She was an eighth grade history teacher.
Really?
Yes.
And your dad did what?
My dad was a plastics engineer.
Do you know what that means?
Yes. Well, I do know a couple things. When I was a little kid, his company got hired to design a plastic Coca-Cola can.
Uh-huh.
So they were going to make cans out of plastic for a while. And we had one.
We had
a prototype of Coke in a plastic
friends?
Can. All the time. All the time. It was like a big, trophy on the shelf.
You guys
and when
want to
we
see
moved,
cool?
We lost it.
Oh.
We lost the plastic Coke. It was such a bummer.
Where'd you move to?
We just moved just to another house, like 10 minutes away. But somehow in the packing and unpacking process, this class, I don't know.
The prototype
didn't
went
away.
It?
No.
So like kids would come over and be like, isn't this cool? This is the only one there is.
Yes, I know. And I used to freak out like when I would throw parties or something in my youth that someone was going to fuck with it or like open it or do you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, someone drank the plastic Coke.
Was there really Coke in it?
Yeah, there was Coca-Cola in it. It was filled. It was like
but was
they
the only
manufactured
one.
Some.
Right.
Well, I'm sure maybe some other guys had them too, but never went on the shelves. Like it never made it out of the sort of, you know, sampling process.
And that was your dad's company?
He worked for that company.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he also, you know, when you buy those biscuits in the freezer and they're in that container
that
and you
pop open?
Yeah. His team invented that packaging and he was part of the patent for that, I believe.
But they're not
his
in the
company.
Freezer. Are they?
Well, no, they're in the refrigerated section.
Right.
And they're also not made out of plastic. But for whatever reason, he told me when I was little.
The ones where you hit it and it pops open?
Yeah.
Those are so exciting.
I know, right? And so we always had a lot of biscuits growing up. I remember that also. So we had a lot of biscuits and a plastic
can filled
with
Coke. It was just one of those things where, you know, you'd see the commercial, you know, for the popping up. I think it was a Pillsbury product, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to see it go pop, you wanted that.
You wanted it.
Yeah.
You want to do it when you get it home, too.
Yeah, it's exciting. Like, and if it duds, you're pissed. Like if you don't hit it quite right, but it opens enough for it not to pop, but to fuck it up.
Yep, you have to stab it with a knife or something.
Yeah,
it's a bummer.
Worst. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you peel out the biscuits. Those biscuits are okay.
Yeah.
So you grew up with those, huh?
Yep, had a lot of those.
With the built-in butter, there's already it's already buttery inside.
Already buttered for you. But you will add more butter after
sure.
it's baked as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
When did you start this need to be looked at and as a performer?
It's so weird because I think that if you met me and my sister or if you saw us growing up, everyone would think she would be the performer.
I like the pictures in your book.
Oh, yeah.
They're kind of funny.
Yeah, as the photos in the book will show you, I was often in the background of things.
Well, I mean, but you
kind of grew up in the background.
You were a kid, did you?
Yeah, a little. I mean,
but she's younger than you. How did you manage to get in the background of a younger sibling?
I was just more of an introvert. I was just more of like, just more cerebral, more of a thinker, just like in my head way more. And she was more presentational and doing dances for the relatives at Christmas.
But in a happy way you were thinking?
Me? Like? No. I mean, in just always very, for my whole life, if I'm not sort of like tortured by figuring out things, then I don't know who I am. Like that's my default. I mean, in high school, everyone else is like watching soap operas in the senior lounge.
Yeah.
And I'm pointing out the subliminal messaging and advertising that's keeping women down.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's like, that's like, I'm just worried about the whole world and everything all the time.
Right. So a lot of people are like, nah, I don't know if we don't invite her.
I mean, I had my close friend, but I wasn't like a fun time gal.
No?
I was more serious.
But were you like, so you didn't hang out with the cool kids?
I didn't, but my school didn't totally have cool kids.
Oh, really?
I went to an all-girls high school.
Oh, my God.
It was amazing.
Good.
It changed my life.
Really?
Yes. Absolutely.
Just to not to be pestered or have...
You know what it was? I had gone to public school my whole life and
before high school
went to the junior high, hated it, was definitely not popular. There were definitely cool kids and I was not one of
them.
Were
you bullied?
No, I was invisible. Like no one knows they went to school with me.
Why?
No one knows.
But you're so, you know, you seem...
Quiet, thinking about stuff, just trying to stay out of everybody's way.
So you,
I didn't want to be cool, didn't want to be a nerd. Like,
so
I'm there.
You wanted to be invisible.
Kind of. Yeah. Just don't notice me was my goal. And then I got to high school. And I changed I changed high schools because my mom was this eighth grade history teacher at a Catholic school.
Yeah.
And I became friends with some of the girls in that class, her eighth grade class when I was in eighth grade. And they were all going to this one Catholic girls' school in St. Louis called Narix Hall. And I said, I want to go to school with them. I want them to be my friends. So I went and I toured and my parents said, okay, we'd love it.
Yeah.
And then I remember sitting in my freshman class and they made an announcement that we're going to have elections for student government. And I thought to myself, oh my God, a girl is going to be president of the class because it's all we have. Like at the public schools, a boy was president, mm-hmm. a girl was vice president, yeah. a boy was treasurer, a girl was secretary. It was just how it was. And that just like, it exploded my mind. And then also at my school, like being smart and caring about things and caring about the world and doing well in school, that made you cool. There was like a competition to raise your hand in class yeah. and have the right answer. So right. We weren't competing for boys or boys' attention or what we were wearing because we all wore uniforms. It really was like
the life changing.
Yes. And by the way, like this person who'd been inside of me thinking all this time
right.
could now extrovert.
Right.
And so I extroverted in high school.
Oh, thank God.
And I loved it.
Uniforms in the all-girls school.
Loved it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was great.
Huh. Well, yeah, I guess that, like, you know, boys and it doesn't, like, public schools with boys and girls can be brutal on both sides.
Yeah. Like, I think it's worse all for stifling. Girls.
No, I mean, like, girls are going to give you shit and boys are going to give you, like,
yes,
if you're
yes.
a vulnerable person or a sensitive person or different, you're going to get it from just the nature of that culture.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas everybody in a all-girls school where you have to wear a uniform and education is put at a premium, it's great. Just gets all that other shit out of the way.
Completely.
Oh.
And cool. I had my little group of friends.
Lifesaver.
Yeah. I had this cool group of friends. There were four of us. Two of the girls were like way more wild and like smoked cigarettes and smoked pot and snuck out of their house and stuff. And then the other girl who was kind of my best friends. We were like two sets of best friends who were then best friends. She was like me. She was like into like listening to Edie Brickell and saving the environment. Mm. And that wasn't me, but we were like this sort of like cerebral follow the rules girls.
Yeah.
And then we had like this other couple of girls who were like the break the rules girls.
So what in
it was a nice balance.
But what did you like, you know, what'd you do? Did you say that?
Oh,
to them?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like so cool. Like, what do you mean? Like, you don't have a curfew? They didn't have a curfew. Ellen and I had curfews, yeah. You know, but like,
they didn't
have a curfew.
What about the boys?
Oh, they dated boys. They had boyfriends.
Yeah.
I didn't have a boyfriend until my senior year.
So you were living vicariously through
completely.
These.
Tell us stories. Tell me about losing your virginity. What was it like? You know, all of that.
They did that when you were in high school?
They did, yeah.
Yeah.
We were just late to the
And was
party.
That a good story?
Their stories?
Yeah.
No. It was a bad, it was like a huge, it was like the, any sex talk my parent could have had with me could not compare to like your girlfriend telling you, trust me, don't do it. Just don't do it.
Wait it out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad. But I guess that's the way it is. Did those friendships hold up?
I'm still friends with them.
The wild girls?
With the wild girls who have now, of course, settled down and have families and children and all uh-huh. these things back in St. Louis. They all three of those gals still live in St. Louis. And I reconnected with them at our 10-year high school reunion. And because at college, we all went to different places. We kind of lost touch.
Yeah.
But we all saw each other at our 10-year reunion and we've stayed in touch ever since.
The 10-year reunion?
Yeah, the 10-year.
So you weren't even a big star then?
No.
Yeah.
I had not been on the office for my 10-year.
That is a bold move. To go back as somebody who wants to be an actress.
As a struggling actress in LA.
To go back to your 10-year. I couldn't do it.
No?
No. I didn't go back until at least I had a couple credits.
Yeah, I went back. I haven't been to one since. So I guess I'm that person.
Yeah, I guess you are now.
I'm like, well, now I've made it.
Yeah,
so
they know who I am.
I don't have time.
No, I think I went back for a 25. But there was no way I was going to 10.
No.
No, couldn't field the questions. So like you're doing comedy and what is that? Are you on TV? I'm not on TV.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it.
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it because it's like, well, what have you done?
Yeah.
What have I seen you in?
Well,
I don't know. Did you come to an experimental theater performance for two nights in LA?
But then it lets them be condescending. But it doesn't sound like, you know, it sounds like you would have had a good time anyways because that high school seemed like everybody... Well, you had a lot of friends there.
Yeah, everybody was pretty cool.
Yeah, but like just a regular like high school to go back to that and to allow the people that never left to have a right to condescend.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, good call on the LA thing, huh?
Didn't work. Right?
Uh-uh.
Yeah.
So I didn't
get it.
Yeah. So tell me about this thing, because like this book, and it's interesting that your sister's a teacher and your mom's a teacher, because it seems that you have teacher in you.
Yeah, my mom will be so flattered by
no, that. No, but I mean, I feel that. It seems like that, like this book, like outside, like it's, it doesn't seem like you're like, I'm going to make some money on a bestseller.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, I want to help some dreamers out.
Yeah, I've made $0 so far. I did not take an advance on the book.
I just want to.
You're correct that I have not been doing it for money thus
far. I want to be practical and temper people's, you know, ridiculous dreams.
Yeah. Well, you know what it is? I wanted to be an actress, and I thought that if I went to college and I got training and then I showed up in LA, it would happen. I was like so naive. I was like, and all I needed to do was network. I just had to find
you knew
these,
that much.
So I had to find these parties.
Yeah.
These
sure.
fictitious parties, mythical parties. And I would meet people who would then cast me in things.
Well, what was the process of getting to that? Because there's pictures and you write about being doing stuff in high school.
Yeah.
These little productions. But what was the decision? Was it when you first auditioned, were you like fraught with fear and you didn't know what you were, you know, like was it
like in high school and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how did it,
you know, in my high school, we only did these big one every year. We did a big musical and I can't sing. So
you could just tuck away. And
yeah, I could just be in the dancing chorus and sew costumes and like hang out and wait for my turn to dance.
Right.
You know, and like chit chat.
And that's exactly what you do, right? You just sit there and you're like, here it comes.
Yeah.
Don't fuck it up. You've got one thing to do.
I'm going to dance my heart out.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So my senior year, they decided to do a stage play for some reason. And I finally got to audition. And I got cast as one of the four leads.
In?
It, this Mad Women of Shiloh.
Huh.
It's this oldie timey comedy about
costumes.
Oh yeah, hats with feathers and corsets and things.
When I was in high school, we did in junior high. I think we did Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yes, same costumes.
Oh yeah,
same. So what is that time period? I called it old timey.
Maybe it was
the 20s. What is that? I don't know.
Maybe even a little earlier. Maybe.
Yeah, the
somewhere
10s?
Around there. Somewhere around there.
Okay.
Yeah. Turn of the century. Yeah.
Yes.
Uh huh.
And so. So I got to be in that, and that was like the first like real acting role that I had before going off to college.
Oh.
And when I went to college, I didn't major in theater at first, but I always wanted to go to LA. I begged my parents to let me go to LA out of high school.
Yeah.
I begged them to take me to this like weekend fair in St. Louis where you supposedly met Hollywood agents. And then
when
I was in high school, and that they would sign me.
And you had done this one play.
I'd done one play, and I just was like, but I don't want to wait. I don't want to go to college.
How did you know about this? You just brought
it. It was like in the paper or something. You know, it was like an ad in the paper.
I had not remembered that production of Meet Me in St. Louis in a long time. I don't think I've talked about it.
Do you have pictures from it?
I used to have pictures. I had a big chest, like a mustache with chops. I was the boss, three-piece suit, pocket watch.
Do you have to sing? Did you have a song?
No, it wasn't a musical, the Meet Me in St. Louis.
Well, I guess they made a musical movie of it,
they
though,
did.
Right?
They
but
did.
The original Meet Me in St. Louis is a
it
play.
Wasn't. It was a play.
Oh.
Yeah. And but the reason I remembered is there's at some point where someone throws water in my face and I come back out. Like I'm supposed to go out and I get hit with water and then I come back out on set wet. And most of my mustache had come off. And I come back outside not knowing that, and they're laughing backstage because it had stuck to the door.
Oh,
the, it was. I just remember that.
How'd you deal with that? Was that like, did that torture you, or was it like, did it become some of the lore of the theater then? Like, remember when Mark's mustache stuck to the door?
Well, the weird thing
and
is,
and everyone talked about it at the cast party afterwards.
I don't know. This was like junior high. We didn't have a theater at that school. Somebody, a teacher, must have decided to have some sort of theater thing, you know, to do a play.
Because
I remember we just did it in the gym and set it up. And it was very young. I didn't do it in high school.
Oh.
So like there was no infrastructure. There was no cultural or community infrastructure around the theater kids or anything. It happened in a vacuum.
Right.
So no.
Okay.
It didn't make any lore.
It didn't make any lore.
But I would like to know where those pictures are.
Yeah.
Because somebody took big black and white pictures. I think the woman who was in charge of the show. They were in the yearbook. Anyways,
you have to track them down.
I'm sorry, this kind of jarred something in my memory. And I don't need to talk about me.
I enjoyed that story. That brought me back to the times of, you know, things going wrong on set in high school and just how dramatic it became. And then we would just like, you're just like drinking beer at the cast party afterwards. And
yeah.
Everyone's like, I don't know. I just screwed it up. And I feel like everybody could see,
yeah.
You know, and then that person's like crying and you're like, it's okay. We have tomorrow night. It's going to be all right. I'm like, no one noticed.
Yeah. In high school. Yeah. If something goes wrong or a wardrobe thing or like
theater circle,
yeah.
Theater in college, it's all the same. It's so narcissistic. Yeah. It's wonderful. It's great.
And then that feeling when you're in college and you, like, I went to plays in college and I did stage troupe in college, which was the non-acting school acting thing.
Uh-huh.
But like when you go to the plays where people are taking real risks.
Yeah.
Maybe a little nudity.
Oh, yeah.
And just sort of like, and it's college and you can see that they're not really comfortable with this. This is not.
My favorite are college productions where like someone has to play the old man. And they've done like the Ben Nye makeup shading from their Ben Nye makeup kit that they learned in their makeup class. Yeah, yeah. And they're like doing all the physicality of old and their voice has changed. And, you know, I love it. It's so, talk about commitment. Like you don't, I mean, I know Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln, that is a type of commitment, but right. I'm sorry, you show me a college kid playing an old man and I'll show you commitment.
There's some guy.
That's some real shit.
It is some real shit.
Yeah.
I remember some guy did another, in that same high school, someone did Crap's Last Tapes. Is that the name of it?
Oh, yeah.
And the guy did full on, like, you know, little big man makeup.
Yeah.
Like they figured out how to put the paint glue on so it crunches up and everything.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, hello. I'm very old.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you imagine? I would never do that today. Like that's terrifying.
To what?
To try to transform into an old person using like makeup shading and my body language.
But would you let somebody make you an old person?
Yeah, I've done that where they put all the latex on you and
you
stuff.
You did?
Yeah, I didn't like it. I felt very claustrophobic.
For which show? Which
that
movie?
Was in the movie Walk Hard.
Oh, right.
I had to be old Darlene and I had to spend 3 days and I kept telling myself that it would be okay because time passes and this will end, that Wednesday at 7 o'clock will happen because it must happen, and then I will not have to have this on my face anymore. Like, I had to like really talk myself down from
that's
it.
That's practical self-parenting.
I was like really like, and I didn't like talking to people. Like I felt it was just very,
yeah.
I did not like it.
So, okay, so you go to the high school, they take you to the big agency signing.
They don't take me. They refuse. My parents refuse to take me to
be signed by a big Hollywood agent?
They won't do it. Apparently, they knew that it was some sort of money-making scheme.
It was a racket?
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yes. So, they told me that I could move to Los Angeles, but I had to go to college. They said, you have to go to college.
Which means, like, we're hoping that she'll get that out of her system during college? Or
you know, I don't think so. I think that they were very supportive, but... And I don't know what their thinking was, you need something to fall back on.
Yeah.
So they would say things like, why don't you become a newscaster? As if being on, just being on camera is what I mean.
Like
right?
Local TV?
You could do it here. Be a newscaster.
Go talk to your father knows what's his name at the station.
Yeah, just do that. Which is not acting, it's journalism. It's like a complete other profession.
Well, let's not go crazy.
Yeah, you know, it's reporting. Yeah,
it's broadcasting.
It's broadcasting.
Yeah.
So I went and I got a minor in journalism and I originally...
So you're actually, that stuck in your craw? You're like, maybe I will.
I was like, I guess. I mean, I don't know. And then I majored in history at first.
Where, what college?
Truman State University.
What is that?
It's a tiny liberal arts school in Missouri, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I toured a bunch of schools and I just liked Kirksville, the little town that Truman was in. I kind of just, I don't know, I wanted to live on my own after the mandatory year in the dorms and it just felt safe and small and close to home but far from home and it just was...
How far away was it?
3.5 hours.
Oh yeah, okay.
So if I wanted to go home on a weekend, I could, but I also like...
It wasn't too close.
Yeah.
They couldn't keep coming up.
Correct. Yeah. So it was good.
Far enough to be
separation without separation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was fine, and it was great. And then by my junior year, I became a full-time theater major.
Yeah?
Yeah, because I just was always doing the theater. I also realized as I was studying, because I was a pre-law history major, I realized as I was like having to write a paper about something in the library before computers, and you had to actually go to a library, I realized I liked acting like a lawyer. And pretending to be a lawyer, but I did not like researching things.
You didn't like the law.
I didn't actually like the law.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So I gave it up.
You gave up the law.
Yeah. I liked pretending like I was in a montage of a person studying and writing a paper, but I didn't like actually want to do that.
Coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Like I would set it up like a little scene. Look at me at the library in my studying montage.
So when he started studying acting full on, how much of what you learned there is what all you needed to know? What was the acting program at Truman?
Truman State University.
Yeah.
It was a lot of reading plays. So it was a lot of like that kind of like academic work. So I really am happy for that. I'm happy that when I'm on a set, I know who Chekhov is and I read all those plays, and I know contemporary American playwrights, and I like that knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, we had to read Greek tragedies and all those sorts of things, so I'm happy for that. And then acting wise, we mostly studied the Stanislavski method. That was like the most.
Who was the teacher?
I had two teachers, Lee Orchard and John Schmore. They both teach at different schools now. And then our tech professor was this guy Ron Rybkowski, who's still there.
Yeah.
And I never was cast in any lead roles of any main stage shows in college, except for my last summer, Ron Rybkowski, the tech teacher, directed Crimes of the Heart, and he cast me as like the boozy, slutty sister Meg.
Yeah.
And that was awesome.
Yeah.
But besides that, I was all about like the student productions and the lab productions and like the sidecar productions.
Which is probably better for learning.
It's better for being an actual working actor because that's what working actors do. They create their own shit. They make their own shit. They have to band together with other people without the support of the department paying for anything and make it happen. Uh-huh. And so that was the best training for actually being an actor.
And these, like, what kind of tools the actual craft goes, did you learn there that you still engage with?
I don't know.
Really?
I mean,
that's honest.
I mean, because I've kind of moved away from the Stanislavski method, which involves kind of poring over your script and writing out intentions for every line. Like, on this line, my intention is to abuse. And on this line, my intention is to embarrass. You know, like I just like that was what my studying was to like create intentions for every.
But I assume
thing
you're supposed to
and create beats, creating beats. I do that still.
Sure.
For long scripts. And actually, I've done some plays.
Making choices. Sure.
Yeah. And some of the background work. I still have this form that they gave me in college about how to break down a character.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's like a 5-page fill in the blank form.
Is
about
it in the book?
No, because it's from a book and I didn't know if I could reprint it, but it's great. It's like, give me your 10 given circumstances, which are things that you've learned from the script that you know about your character.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And it could be anything that is said about you or said to you.
Uh-huh.
But that was another thing, like the difference between information that's said about you, but that your character didn't hear.
Mm.
Like that's a distinction. So like how people feel about you. Like
that
you're a crook,
yeah.
But do you know they think you're a crook?
Right.
Because you would play it differently if they know or don't know.
Right.
So some of that way of breaking down a script or a character, I still keep with me. From
so
school.
That little 5-page thing, that stuff.
I still, yeah. And it's like so degraded now. I should really have that retyped for me.
You can do that. You could even do it, maybe make a little project for yourself.
I know.
Retype it.
I should, because it's just like photocopy after photocopy after
but
photocopy
still use
of this
it.
Form. Yeah. And I only have a hard copy of it.
Huh.
I have one blank hard copy that I can still make a photocopy of and then fill
it. That's the thing that survived. You don't know what book it comes from.
I think it came from this little blue hardcover Stanislavski method book.
Hmm.
But I can't find the book either.
That's wild.
And I don't know what the book is called. But there's other things like Moment Before, Like, so that was a big thing for my study. Like, before you enter a room, what were you doing?
Oh, that's a good one.
Make a decision about it. Like, it could be literally anything. If the script doesn't tell you what your moment before is, what is your moment before? So you don't. So you enter the room. Like, nobody, everybody has a moment before in their life before they enter a meeting or a moment or a whatever. And so, like, it just makes it that moment
richer.
So
what do you do once you make that decision? Like, I was just in the bathroom.
When you walk in, you wipe your hands on your on your pants as you're entering. I don't know, something. Yeah, it informs something.
Uh-huh. I like that.
Yeah. I find some of those exercises are just about squashing the vulnerability and anxiety of acting.
Huh.
Of just, it's almost like a security blanket, like something to hold on to.
You've worked with a lot of great actors, and you've worked, you know, that John C. Reilly in Walk Hard, right?
Yeah.
And he's like an interesting actor. Do you learn from other actors?
I learned so much from John C. Reilly.
Him?
Yeah. Yeah. Both like sort of on set and off set kind of stuff. Cause I was pretty new and Walk Hard was my first role in like a studio movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I had done Blades of Glory before that, but I had such a small role. And but Walk Hard was like a really big deal.
Yeah.
Walk Hard was like the studio hired a physical trainer for me. They sent me to voice lessons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it was like I had like 90 costumes.
Yeah.
I had to be made up into old age makeup. Like, it was this big, huge undertaking.
Yeah.
But no, working with John C. Reilly, he's one of my favorite people that I've ever worked with. Yeah. And I did another movie with him, a little movie called The Promotion that we filmed before Walk Hard.
So you guys
in
knew
Chicago.
Each other. Yeah.
Yes. And we didn't really have any scenes together. But we were in Chicago and just kind of hanging out with Fred Armisen.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, hey, I'm putting together this movie, Walk Hard, and you should come read for it. And then I originally, when I read the script, I assumed they wanted me to come in for the Kristen Wiig role, the sort of like, you know, put upon first wife.
Yeah.
And so that's what I prepared. And then they called and said, oh, no, that's already been cast. Kristen Wiig is doing that role. And I'm like, well, you can't mean the like lead hot, like sexy girl. No one ever casts me as that.
Yeah.
They're like, no, just come in and read, just see.
Yeah.
And I went in and for the audition, Judd Apatow was there and John C. Reilly was there. And I knew John and we had to do this one kind of like sexy scene as the audition. And I remember like, I feel like I like got on John's lap and like licked his face or something. Like, something never happens in auditions, but you think always happens in auditions, right? And I was so glad that I'd done that other movie with him and like been to dinner with him. And
sure.
That he felt familiar. He felt friendly to me and safe.
Yeah.
So I really was able to like go for it. And then I got the part. I was so excited. But then on set, he taught me a lot about on set movie etiquette, things that I didn't really know before.
Yeah.
Like they used to make me up and I thought it was my job to just go sit in my trailer all day. Like and wait to be called.
Yeah.
And John said, he got me aside and he was like, Jenna, why are you sitting in your trailer all the time? And I'm like, well, I thought that was what I was supposed to do. Like, I'm waiting. Like, I'm just like waiting for someone to tell me to come to the set and it's my turn. He's like, no. He's like, you sit on set. You sit on set in a director's chair at Video Village. You like chit chat and you're up there. You're like super ready to go all the time. He's like, that's what you want to be doing, okay? Huh. And I was like, oh, okay. And this was sort of like a third of the way through the movie, and it completely changed my experience after I did that.
But is that protocol, or is that just his way? Because like I would imagine on some sets, you know, if you're that actor, eventually maybe the director's gonna be like, why is she just hanging?
Well, he was even like, bring a book, come sit in a chair.
I always sit on set. I hate trailers.
Yeah, sit on set was what he was basically saying.
Yeah, I like
saying.
Sitting on set.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even like sometimes like I'll go sit even when people are on lunch. When it's just a dark set.
Just sit on the set while everybody's gone?
Yeah.
That actually sounds really peaceful.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Like, because then, and then you
it's
feel
sort of lovely.
Yeah. And then it comes to life. Like right at lunch, after lunch, it's all of a sudden like cranes or things are waking up.
That sounds like an old timey movie.
It's
to bring
true,
back
though.
Old timey. I know. That's so romantic.
No matter on what set it is, like at lunch, like everyone's gone.
Yeah.
All the cameras are just like, ugh. And then like
all of a sudden they're like, ooh.
Yeah. It's just all of a sudden one or two people show up and then it's like,
yeah.
It cranks up, the lights crank up.
Oh my gosh, it's like a type of sunrise.
It is.
Yeah.
But okay, outside of telling you to, you know, hang out at Video Village and be on set, not in your trailer, what else did you learn from John?
Well, he was just like, I don't want to call him a workaholic because I feel like that has a negative connotation, but like he just was always prepared. He was up for anything. He was ready for anything. And he took his job seriously, but not too seriously. Mm-hmm. Like, I just thought he was a great model for how to approach work. He was flexible, but he was also rigid when he needed to be. He was just this really great mentor. And the other thing he told me was, he told me, like, near the end of the movie, he was like, "Jenna, this is not real life." Yeah. And I was like, "What do you mean?" "Yes, it is. All these people are my new best friends, and we're going to keep in touch." And he was like, it was like, without saying it, he was like, "I love you. We had a great time. We have a wonderful rapport. I'm never going to see you again. It doesn't mean anything. Don't get your feelings hurt. And also, none of these people are your friends. And you're never going to see any of them again either." And he was like, "This is a moment in time. This is summer camp." Because I think he could see that I was like new and naive. And
you still have sort of that kind of college theater thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And trading numbers. Can't wait to get together for dinner in a couple weeks. Yeah. You know, and it's true. You don't see any of the people again. Nobody is friends again. And it's over. It's 3 months of your life. And then that's it. But he was also saying, he's like, "So you need to build something real outside of this.
Right.
And he's like, "I do. I have a family. I live outside of the business.
Yeah.
And you don't hear from me until I come on set." And I remember Jack Black saying the same thing once. I heard an interview with him, and he sort of said, "When I'm on set, I'm on, and when I'm off set, I'm off." And I think it's actually really good advice.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of, the intensity of a production is sort of wild.
Yeah.
And then that last day, you still get all of that stuff that you got in college at cast parties and everything, but you really go your different ways, and then maybe you see craft services.
Yeah, on another production.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you see the, you know, an AD or a grip or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, "Oh, we worked it," or, you know, "Yeah, oh yeah, how you been?" Like, but that's it, isn't it?
I just found out that the sound guys who worked on The Office are going to work on my new show that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I like started to cry. I was so excited. I was like, "What? Nick and Brian? Nick and Brian? Oh my God." I was like so excited.
Well, but you were with those guys for
nine years. Yeah. But yeah, like that, I thought that it actually is really good advice, because the industry and working on sets is very intoxicating, and you can get like kind of addicted to it, mm-hmm. I think. And everyone's like good looking and charming and charismatic and funny and smart and amazing. And it's incredible. I mean, it's like a complete like fantasy world.
Yeah, but there's also sort of like, "Oh, that guy. He's like," like there's, you know, there's always going to be one or two of those. Like,
well, yeah, that's true. That's definitely true. but yeah, like just, that I think that's what he was warning me against. He was like, "You seem like," "you seem like a moth that wants to fly really close to the flame, and it just don't get burned out."
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. And also don't get emotionally attached to the romance of it.
Yeah, don't draw, like, this is not your food.
I'm sure you have
this
friends.
This is your candy. I do. I have a lot of friends outside the industry.
No, but I'm sure you have friends.
You can tell me
you don't talk to Grzynski or whatever.
I do. I actually, that's different. I think if you spend a long period of time on a television show, it's like, I always wondered, how do the bachelors and bachelorettes become such good friends on that show?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, they're locked in a house together. And that's what being on a TV show is like. Like, we're locked in that room 12, 14 hours a day for 9 years.
Right.
Like, we're legit friends.
Yeah.
And I see all those people. Those are some of my best friends.
Really? Even BJ Novak?
I see BJ Novak.
Oh, okay.
I love BJ.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We have dinner sometimes.
Okay, good.
It's been a few years.
But
we text, you know, that's like all my friendships are texting friendships and like voicemail friendships.
I used him as a punchline in like 3 seasons of my show.
You did?
Yeah.
That's okay.
He said something very funny to me. Yeah, because it's not good hearted, really. I was very snotty to BJ Novak. It's, you know what I mean?
He can take it.
He can. He's, you
he
know,
can take
the,
it.
He's like, Harvard taught him how to take it.
That's right. It exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also,
he'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Now, he'll be more than fine.
He will.
But he came up to me once after the first season where I used him as a joke. And he looked at me and he's like, "You know, we're cosmically connected now." And I'm like, "I know. I did that." Forever. For as long as anybody watches that show. All right. So now the teaching part of the book. Like, it felt to me like when I was looking through it that, like, you know, you express a certain amount of vulnerability in that you show you know, the sort of weird, not so quiet desperation
of being an actor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, but exposing that, like, because when you do shitty headshots and you put them out in the world,
yeah,
you don't know that at first.
You don't. When I'm taking those headshots, I think they're fantastic. I sent them to many agents and casting directors. It was not until I compiled them for the book that I realized I had worn overalls, the same pair of overalls, in three of my headshots spanning 5 years. What is that? What's wrong with me? Seriously.
I don't know. But I look at so many of my clothing choices early on where I'm like, what was I doing on television like that?
Horrible.
Like, I do Conan and stuff, and I was talking to somebody else, a guy who I just met through some other people who lived in my neighborhood in Queens, said he was a clothing designer.
Oh.
And I let him design a shirt and
that's
pants
great,
for me.
Great choice.
That I wore on Conan great. For the first time. And I'm like, what?
That's so nice of you.
What was I doing?
What were you doing?
But what were you doing in overalls for 5 years?
It's what I wore. I thought in a headshot, wear your favorite outfit. Clearly, overalls were my favorite outfit. I had a really, like, a lumberjack period.
But
apparently.
Did you get work off of those headshots?
No, of course I didn't get any work. And of course I'm blaming my agent or my non-existent agent. I got, no. But, no, the idea behind the book and when you talk about it being teaching is just, I came out to LA and I thought I knew what I was supposed to do with my training. And I didn't know it all.
Which was what? You were just going to be chosen.
Yes. Wait to be chosen.
So when you went to college and you did this, did you have some sort of primer? Did somebody hip you to the business? Was there a class
No.
that said how it was supposed to go? So what were you basing that on?
I don't know. On stories I'd heard about Pam Anderson being at a baseball game and then the camera goes over to her on the Jumbotron and then a modeling agent gives her a card.
That's Pam Anderson.
Exactly.
She's a freak of nature.
I know. But then, some other thing like, oh, this person some stand-up and then this producer was like, I must have you and here's a TV show.
And so isn't it
weird
though?
You're like, what?
You believe that? And that first time you drive into LA and you're like, where's the city?
There's that too. Like, where am I in it? Am I here yet? I guess I'm here.
I lived here for like a year before I left. Like, I came here for a year or so and I left and came back years later. But I was like in Culver City.
Oh, yeah. You were like
living in in a roommate situation. Just sort of like, how do I get in?
Yeah.
You drive by Paramount. What is it? What's in there?
Yeah. How do I get in there? So the idea is, here's everything I learned during my just like 5 years of complete and utter just depression.
But you talk about interesting, like, fairly specific stuff, doing extra work, Taft-Hartley. Mm-hmm. I had to be Taft-Hartley'd, and I still don't know what it is.
I know, right? I sort of say that in the book. I'm like, listen, here's a way to get into SAG. Good luck. But
do they still do it? You got to.
Yeah, you still Taft-Hartley. You can get Taft-Hartley'd.
That means is like you don't have to pay your dues on your first job.
Yeah, it means that you got a job and you weren't in the union, but they needed you specifically, so they made an exception and put you in.
And usually that's like somebody you know, a friend, gets you a little gig, maybe one line that might not even make it into the movie or the TV show, so you can get in the union.
Correct, yeah.
So that's still like, if you're just someone in St. Louis, you know, you're gonna need that friend.
But that's the thing. I come to LA like looking for that way of getting in the union, but that's so rare. It's like winning the lottery.
Right.
So I try to talk a lot about all the things I learned and tell all of my embarrassing funny stories, but also pack the book with like real practical information like that too for like aspiring actors.
It's just the horror of like, I didn't do that. I did it. I was always a comic. So I spared myself what you guys go through. I don't know how one does that. You know, just goes out on auditions constantly.
How do you go out on stage and do comedy? That is harder.
But that was my life. You know, like I've been doing that. You know, that was all I ever wanted to do. It was genetically inclined somehow. Like I didn't think I had a choice, but that was my chosen avenue. I didn't get in it to be an actor. I got in it to be a comic.
Yeah.
And whatever. But you know the course of it. You know, like after you do it for a while, you're like, well, you want to get your own show or whatever. All that stuff. But But like when I just go out on auditions before, you know, and no one knew me for years up until like, you know, like what, 6 years ago. And most people still don't know me. But like you go to those auditions and sometimes you'd walk down hallways that were just like, there were just stacks of headshots.
Yeah.
All along the hallway. And you're just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
All these people think it's going to happen.
It's true. It's true.
And to me, that scene, like going into a casting director's office and seeing stacks of hundreds of headshots
mm-hmm.
was too much for me to bear. I'm like, this ain't my path. I can't do this. I can't do that.
See, that's interesting because when you talk about that, like I feel like I never decided to be an actor. It was just like what I was going to be.
Well, that's how I felt about comedy.
Yeah. So I just had to like figure that out. I had to like conquer that part of I had to audition. I had to figure out how to do all that. I did.
Yeah, for me, it was like I had to figure out how to be myself. Like the job for me was how do I how do I become singular? Not how do I, you know, fit into whatever they're looking for here in this hallway.
Yes, right, right.
You know what I mean?
But that's hard, and you've talked about that before about finding your comedic voice, your authenticity.
Yeah, there's
in your comedy.
There's no book for that.
That's just years and trial and error and just
something,
doing it.
You know, yeah, hopefully, yeah, you eventually land in yourself one way or the other, whether it's a caricature or whatever. But you are too, though, because you, over the years, there's something intrinsic about you that's going to come out in all of your work. And it's a known quantity now, and you're comfortable with it, right?
Yeah, I'm not like one of those transform myself actors.
Right. Well, that's fine.
I'm going to be like, I'm an everyman and you're meant to see yourself in me. And there's varying degrees of people in that range.
Yeah.
But I'm not looking to
put on weight or do accents.
Well, you don't want to hear me do accents. They're ridiculous. Like my husband and I do accents for each other just when we want to do a bit because it's ridiculous. I was doing French waiter for my children the other night and he was like dying. He was like, this is the worst.
Your husband was?
He was dying laughing. He was like, this is the worst French waiter.
He's an actor?
He's a writer director.
Right.
And my daughter in the middle of my French waiter, she's three. And she said, Mama, we don't understand what you're saying. Like, your accent is so bad. We don't understand what you're saying.
Not working.
It was very bad. But
like, how'd you get the office? How'd that happen? Like, how many times? Because you had done a lot of little TV parts. You'd been kicking around for how long?
8 years.
8 years?
8 years.
And you were still gung-ho?
Yeah, I know.
You got enough work to keep you?
No. After 6 years, I was finally earning as much money from acting as I did from my day job that I had before that.
Uh-huh.
So year 6 and 7, I was able to make that same amount of money as I did as an administrative assistant prior. But it was through like booking a pilot or booking 3 great guest star roles.
Right.
All of which like were totally unsatisfying and would get my hopes up and then crush all my dreams.
Right.
And then I cried and said I was going to give up. I told everybody I was giving up, that I was done. And my manager and agent told me that this is what an actor's life is, and asked me if I was an actor or not. And they said this could go on for years and years. So are you an actor or are you not an actor?
Oh my God. I would have been like, I don't know.
I know. I was so angry. I was so mad. I mean, I was like crying and I was like, it's too hard and you're not doing it and you don't even know. It is crushing my soul. And I was like crying, sure. Sucking air. And and my manager really convinced me and my acting coach convinced me to just roll through it, just roll through that and keep going.
Yeah.
And it was that following year then when I got my audition for The Office. But Allison Jones, who cast The Office, cast me in my first television speaking role, which was Spin City, the Charlie Sheen years.
Mm-hmm.
I played a waitress who had 3 lines. So when I had been in L.A. for 5 years, I booked that job with Allison. But that was like my 5th audition with Allison. So I met Allison and she just liked me. And she kept calling me in every year for little things. And I would book some little things and I would crash and burn at other auditions. But she just really believed in me. And then, thank the Lord, she ended up casting The Office and she thought of me and brought me in. So I really owe everything to Allison and to my manager, Naomi, who got me the meeting with Allison originally.
I know her.
Yeah, she's great. And again, like we didn't hit it off because like I brought her brownies or I like schmoozed her. It was really just she called me in. I did my work.
Yeah.
She found it acceptable.
Right.
And we just did that for 3 years. And then I came in for the office. And the office was tough. It was like, you know, it was a lot of pressure because there had been this original version that was beloved, which I loved, the British version. And a lot of people like didn't even want the job because they were sure that
Lucy had your part, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She who's amazing.
I love her. Yeah. I've worked with her before on my show. She's great.
I love her.
Yeah.
I got to meet her.
Yeah. She's great.
Yeah. And so we were all really nervous and everybody was pretty sure that like NBC and all of us were just going to mess
for
it up. For the office?
Yeah.
Who'd you audition for?
For Krasinski's part.
You did?
Yeah. I did.
Wow.
And I had no idea what the other office was. I remember doing it, and I don't remember who was I don't know who my agent was at that time, but it was for John's part. It was for one of the two guys. They kept looking for those two guys.
Yeah.
And
that's so funny because they made John read for Dwight the first time.
Right.
I think because he was like really tall or something.
Everybody read for both parts, but I remember, Greg Daniels is in the room.
Yeah. So did you go, how many times did you go in? Did you just read you went right to see Greg?
Right.
You went straight to producers.
I did go, I must have, because he was there.
Yeah.
And then I got cast in a pilot, a big old pilot with Odenkirk and Janine Garofalo. It was a slice of life, it was called.
Yeah.
Right. And it was supposed to, like, and we were about to go shoot in Vancouver, and they pulled the plug on it after the read-through. And so I think that whatever that momentum was, because that must have been 2003, around the same time.
Did you shoot a pilot of that?
No. We got, they cast it. We had our
plane
tickets. And then they
canceled it before you shot the pilot.
Yeah, we did a full read-through. We had our plane tickets to Vancouver.
Isn't that heartbreaking?
It was a little much.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that's the whole life of an actor. Like, you think something's going to happen. You get attached to it. It's so hard to get the job, and then you get the job, and then the job disappears?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, what else am I supposed to do? Like, how
weird,
else do I succeed?
I think Rain was in that.
So, Rainn Wilson was?
I think so.
No way.
It was all must have been right before The Office, right? Because there was a lot of people in that slice of life thing. Odenkirk had a little part. It was me and Janine, and it was like a full dais of people. It was a big cast.
Well, Bob Odenkirk went out for Michael Scott, mm-hmm. and I actually prepared my auditions with him. I would go and meet with him.
And he's your manager's husband.
My manager's husband.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he would be Michael and I would be Pam and we worked on our auditions together.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So that was pretty crazy. But
I could see him as that. But now it's hard to see anybody but Carell for the American one. And Gervais is, you know, singular, obviously.
Yeah.
But they're very different shows.
Yeah. Very different characters. And yeah, Ricky Gervais came in while we were doing the pilot and he gave us some really great advice about how to Americanize the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he said, you know, in England you can be really bad at your job but you don't get fired, you can just keep it forever. And so he's like, but in America that's not true and people would be very frustrated by that here in America. He's like, I think it wouldn't go over well.
Uh-huh.
He's like, so I suggest, my big suggestion is that Michael Scott is actually a good salesman. And you see that throughout the show. Like, he's a maddening person to be around,
uh-huh.
but he has a charm with clients and he, you know, and also just that, like, he manages to surprise you.
Right.
And that was sort of his suggestion, was that, you know, basically in England, we can live with a lot of abuse and very few sunshines.
Yeah.
But I think in America, you need like a little bit more
interesting
hope in
was
your
that a
show.
Producer's note?
It was, yeah, it was kind of in a meeting that we had where we all got together and ate lunch. And I remembered thinking in that meeting, if nothing else happens from this entire experience, except that I got to sit in a room and eat lunch with Ricky Gervais and listen to him tell us ideas, my life is complete.
It's very smart, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very smart note.
I think so, too. And yeah. Then Stephen Merchant was there, too. And Stephen Merchant said, Jim and Pam, that yeah. the romance between Jim and Pam, it should never be more than, like, I can't remember what he said, but he's like, it should never be more than 20% of every episode. Like, it's just a little something. Like, you come for the comedy, but you stay for the romance, but it's not all about the romance. But that's important.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the heart of the show, but, you know, that's not at its core a love story.
Right. It was a hell of a run, huh?
Incredible. And I've gone back to watch some episodes recently, And they are so good. And yeah. I can't believe that I was on them. And it kind of blows my mind.
Yeah.
Like it feels like a dream.
Really?
I can't believe it. I still have a sense memory of my desk.
Yeah.
And I left before they took it apart. And I didn't want to go into the soundstage after it was gone because I like to imagine it's still there.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
To be dug in like that and to have those connections. To
yeah.
To even a set, you know.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it.
To the place and all yeah. the people and the crew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, but you know, like you said, it's a long time and you did create some relationships there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Now, post office, did you find that, I don't know, I didn't read this part of the book. Did you find, it doesn't seem to me that that role, unlike some other, it was a defining role, but it didn't seem like it would necessarily hobble your ability to be seen as anything else.
No. It didn't. But coming off of the office, I would get a lot of offers for, I think, what people maybe thought I wanted to do. Like, they thought I wanted to blow up the image of Pam. So I would get scripts where they're like, we just think Jenna would be such a surprising choice for this. We just love her for this. So she gets bent over a car and, like, fucked in the ass. And, you know, just her tits are flying, but, like, no one will expect it. And I'm like, what the fuck script is this?
What's
Why
happening?
Are you raping Pam on a car? Like, that is what you are doing. Like, that is so gross. Guys, settle down. I mean, more than one script, like, just something like that,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Very disturbing.
Yeah, we're going to get rid of that character for good.
And exactly.
Yeah, we're going to...
Just going to fuck it out of her.
Do to Pam what Trump's doing to America.
That's seriously, like, so much anger. So much anger at America's little sweetheart Pam, yeah, right? Yeah, I was right. like, I'm so sorry. And I'd be like, no, I think I'm going to not do that. But then I would also get a lot of offers that were Pam.
Yeah.
You know, so right. it was like the sort of something in between was a little harder to find.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, after the office, I had another kid. So I took some time off.
You have two.
I have two.
With the same guy.
With the same man, my husband.
That's good. That's your husband.
It's much easier that way. I find it's like so much less complicated.
But you have another husband, an ex-husband.
I have an ex-husband.
Who was a big director guy.
Yes.
In the world of films that I know nothing about.
Yes. Yes, James Gunn is yeah. my ex-husband, who is the writer-director of the Guardians of the right. Galaxy.
You have no kids with him.
We have no children.
But you're friends still.
We are still friends.
Is that good?
It is good.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
You're not obligated, you know. You're not obligated if you have no kids to stay friends with him.
I know.
Okay.
But I think it's maybe easier to stay friends because we don't have kids, because we don't have to parent from separate homes. That seems so difficult
I guess so. I
me.
Guess maybe if you like him and you end it on good note...
We did. There was no animosity.
Oh.
And
I have no idea what you're talking about.
It was like a surprisingly like
this sounds crazy to me. You're just talking crazy talk.
I know, right? he's an infuriatingly wonderful person who I just couldn't be married to.
Got it.
And vice versa. We were not a match.
Right. And who's the new guy?
Lee Kirk.
Okay.
That's my
what's
the,
and he directs
husband.
And writes?
He's a writer-director.
Of
he
what?
Makes independent films.
Yeah.
That's how we met. And
you've done that. You made a film.
That the film I made with him, the film I produced, was a film that he wrote and then eventually directed.
What's that called?
It's called The Giant Mechanical Man.
Okay.
And it's super good. And it's so sweet. And has Chris Messina and Topher Grace. And I just love it. But they took it off Netflix, so that's annoying.
Oh, well, call somebody.
I know. Yeah. I'm the producer.
Yeah, have Pam
It's my
call.
Job.
Yeah.
I need to make that call.
Topher Grace can be really good sometimes.
I love Topher. I'm
yeah.
doing an animated show with Topher now.
I thought he was great in that movie. What was the one with Dennis Quaid?
Oh.
Good Company? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, exactly.
I like that movie.
It's a great film.
In that movie, you were in that Kopelman movie. Solitary Man.
Yeah.
I like that movie.
Michael Douglas.
Great actor.
Amazing.
Yep.
And I'm getting ready to do a scene where we're walking down a New York street having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like every scene you've ever seen in any Woody Allen movie.
Yeah.
And I turned to him and I said, this is my first New York City walk and talk scene. And he turned to me with like such genuine excitement. He goes, what? I'm your first New York City walk and talk scene? This is fantastic. fantastic. This is going to be great. It was so sweet. Like, he got it, right? Like, he got an actor wants to do a New York City walk and talk.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Like, they stop traffic. And so you're crossing the street or acting like there's traffic, but there's no traffic.
Right.
It's so cool.
Oh, that's great. And he completely showed up for you.
He did.
That's sweet.
He got that it was special.
And so what's happening now? You got to get going. So the book is happening. It's helpful. It's good. It'll put your dream into perspective.
Yeah.
If you want to do acting.
All those things.
Yeah.
So I have that.
Carell writes the foreword, but you have these weird interviews.
I do. I interviewed 4 working actors that you probably don't recognize, but they work all the time. And to me, that should be your goal when you set out to have a career in acting, because that is a successful career. So it shouldn't be about being famous or being recognizable, but like a working actor it's working. So yeah, I interview these 4 working actors, and Derek Waters, the creator of Drunk History, is one of the people that I interview.
Yeah, I should get him in here. I like that guy.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he did. He was on Marin, my show, and he was funny. And Drunk History is funny. I don't drink, though, so I can't do it.
But you could be on it. You could be a performer on it.
He's never asked me, so maybe we'll work that out.
I know. I've known Derek for 15 or 16 years, and it wasn't until last year that he finally asked me.
I think he's
Drunk
a good
History.
Actor.
I do, too.
Yeah.
I've known him for a long time.
Yeah. How'd you meet him?
We had the same manager, and we ended up going to the same acting coach.
Who's that?
Robert DeVonzo, and he's amazing.
Yeah?
And he transformed my career.
How?
He taught me how to audition. He taught me how to audition effectively, and he deprogrammed my mind. He taught me what I should be expecting from the industry and what I shouldn't and what I should be doing for myself. He was part therapist. But not in the sleazy, annoying way that acting teachers want to take you back to your childhood traumas and make you spill out your guts in class. I hate that. It was about just cutting out all the bullshit, bringing yourself to a role, and then also just literally teaching me what everything I was doing wrong in my auditions.
Oh,
He doesn't teach you how to act. He's like, that's your go to acting school. You know, he has acting classes, but for this audition class, he's like, I'm teaching you how to audition, which is a completely different skill and one that I hadn't learned. And I didn't understand why I wasn't getting cast in things.
What was the primary trick?
Memorize the first 3 lines of every scene. So that especially if you're only given a small amount of time with the material, because sometimes you get there and here's your scene. Memorize the first 3 lines so your face is up, because they make almost all their decisions within the first 3 lines of a scene. Pick one moment where you're going to make a dramatic choice in the scene, but just one, and then actively listen when the other person is talking. Don't look down at your script for your next line. Make sure that there are times when your eyes are up and you're listening and reacting to the casting director or the other person reading.
Mm.
And then he also taught me about the questions that you can ask in order to help inform your performance at an audition. Like little things, like on a scale of 1 to 10, how broad is this? 10 being super broad, 1 being not at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then the casting director will say, oh, it's probably about a 7. And then you do it and they're like, you know what, I'm sorry, bring it up to a 9. Engage them, help them direct you,
right?
And knowing how to ask questions.
Wow.
So he's awesome.
That's great. And that's where you met Derek.
That's where I met Derek.
And you still work with Naomi?
I still work with Naomi.
And you have 2 kids?
And I have 2 kids.
And you like them?
I love them.
Good. And your parents are still with us?
My parents are still alive.
And
yeah.
They're proud of you?
They are proud of me. But anytime my mom says she's proud of me, she's going to remind you that she's also very proud of her other daughter, who is not a famous actress, but who is a wonderful teacher in St. Louis.
Good.
Keeps it equal.
And you're going to do that with your kids?
I guess so, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as an experiment, I suppose I could just heap pride on one child and not the other and see how it goes. But that seems I feel like my mom's doing it right.
Yeah, no, that's one of the good things you learned from them.
I did.
Try to take the good thing. How old are your kids?
My kids are almost 6 and 3.
All right, so they haven't really proved themselves yet. So
they haven't. I mean, they have a long way to go. I mean, we'll see if I'm proud of them. We don't know yet.
Yeah, play it by ear.
Yeah, we'll
but prepare
see.
To be proud.
I'm prepared. I'll prepare for the best.
Good. Thank you for talking.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. Wasn't that great? I liked it. I'll play a little guitar, I think. I deprived you of that. Maybe that was a pleasure. for you not to have it, but I'll do it now.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.